Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. It is marvelous Monday, September 10th, 2012. A great day to be alive. This is the Think and Grow Rich call. My name is Paul Hutchings, dialing in from Southeast Idaho. Thank you for being here. I'm excited to be here, my friend. You know, over the weekend, I was thumbing through my journal, doing a little bit of reflecting, doing a little bit of pondering, and I ran across a line that was shared with us last week that I want to share with you just real quick as we start the call. Because it's powerful, and that line is, the student searches the world for meaning, the master finds worlds of meaning in the search. The student searches the world for meaning, the master finds worlds of meaning in the search. I'm so grateful for whoever shared that with us last week, and I didn't catch the name, but that's a powerful line, isn't it? Last night I was relaxing with my family, and we were watching a movie, and we were watching the movie The Princess Bride. And if you haven't watched that movie, I recommend it. It's a funny movie. It's a great family movie. It'll make you laugh. But one of the characters in that movie is an individual who, as a young boy, he was 11 years old, and his father was killed by a villain. His father was a sword maker, and he was making this sword for this villain, and this villain shows up and says, I'm taking the sword, and I'm only going to give you 1/10 of the price, and his father says no, and so the villain kills his father. Well, this young man, for the next 20 years, he devotes his life to the study of fencing, and he decides that I'm going to devote my entire life to the sole purpose of tracking down this villain that killed my father, and I'm going to avenge my father's death. And all throughout his life, he's practicing, and he has the line that he's going to say to this guy. And he says, and this line is, my name is Unigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die. And he's spending his entire life, and he's tracking this down. Well, simple movie, right? And you know, simple story. But what can you find as you're looking for meaning in that? Well, folks, this gentleman in this movie selected a major definite purpose. And probably not the best example of a major definite purpose, but you know what? After 20 years, I'll let you watch the movie to find out whether or not he achieved that major definite purpose. But as a student of Think and Grow Rich, you know that by selecting a major definite purpose and by holding fast to it, odds are extremely high that you're going to achieve that major definite purpose. So just keep that in mind. The student searches the world for meaning. The master finds worlds of meaning in the search. And there are worlds of meaning in our search, my friends, in everything we do. As a matter of fact, as I was watching that movie, I realized that I need to start having my journal out when I watch movies with my children, because there's meaning in those movies. There are life lessons in those movies. There are things we can learn about influence and marketing in those movies. So that's one thing I'm going to do moving forward. You know, on this call, I have my notepad out. I'm taking notes. Why? Because this is part of the search for me, and I'm looking for meaning. I'm looking for those worlds of meaning. So I just want to challenge everyone as we move forward in life and in business, be the master, be the one who's looking for those worlds of meaning. Now, that being said, we're continuing on in our study of the book Think and Grow Rich, and we're going to finish out, I believe it's chapter 2 today, with a story that's incredible, that's amazing, that is miraculous, and it's entitled Desire Outwits Mother Nature. And again, I want to challenge each of us to look for the worlds of meaning that are contained within this story. Look for the principles we can extract and apply into our own lives. And this is a personal story from the life of Dr. Napoleon Hill. As a fitting climax to this chapter, I wish to introduce one of the most unusual persons I have ever known. I first saw him 24 years ago, a few minutes after he was born. He came into the world without any physical sign of ears, and the doctor admitted when pressed for an opinion that the child might be deaf and mute for life. I challenged the doctor's opinion. I had the right to do so. I was the child's father. I, too, reached a decision and rendered an opinion, but I expressed the opinion silently in the secrecy of my own heart. I decided that my son would hear and speak. Nature could send me a child without ears, but nature could not induce me to accept the reality of the affliction. In my own mind, I knew that my son would hear and speak. How? I was sure there must be a way, and I knew I would find it. I thought of the words of the immortal Emerson. The whole course of things goes to teach us faith. We need only obey. There is guidance for each of us, and by lowly listening, we shall hear the right word. The right word? Desire. More than anything else, I desired that my son should not be a deaf mute. From that desire, I never receded, not for a second. Many years previously, I had written, "Our own limitations are those we set up in our own minds." For the first time, I wondered if that statement were true. Lying on the bed in front of me was a newly born child, without the natural equipment of hearing. Even though he might hear and speak, he was obviously disfigured for life. Surely this was a limitation which that child had not set up in his own mind. What could I do about it? Somehow I would find a way to transplant into that child's mind my own burning desire for ways and means of conveying sound to his brain without the aid of ears. As soon as the child was old enough to cooperate, I would fill his mind so completely with a burning desire to hear that nature would, by methods of her own, translate it into physical reality. All this thinking took place in my own mind, but I spoke of it to no one. Every day I renewed the pledge I had made to myself not to accept a deaf mute for a son. As he grew older and began to take notice of things around him, we observed that he had a slight degree of hearing. When he reached the age when children usually begin talking, he made no attempt to speak, but we could tell by his actions that he could hear certain sounds slightly. That was all I wanted to know. I was convinced that if he could hear even slightly, he might develop still greater hearing capacity. Then something happened which gave me hope. It came from an entirely unexpected source. We bought a Victrola. When the child heard the music for the first time, he went into ecstasies and promptly appropriated the machine. He soon showed a preference for certain records. Among them, "It's a Long Way to Tipperary." On one occasion, he played that piece over and over for almost 2 hours, standing in front of the Victrola with his teeth clamped on the edge of the case. The significance of this self-formed habit of his did not become clear to us until years afterward, for we had never heard of the principle of bone conduction of sound at that time. Shortly after he appropriated the Victrola, I discovered he could hear me quite clearly when I spoke with my lips touching his mastoid bone or at the base of his brain. These discoveries placed in my possession the necessary media by which I began to translate into reality my burning desire to help my son develop hearing and speech. By that time, he was making stabs at speaking certain words. The outlook was far from encouraging, but desire, backed by faith, knows no such word as impossible. Having determined that he could hear the sound of my voice plainly, I began immediately to transfer to his mind the desire to hear and speak. I soon discovered that the child enjoyed bedtime stories, so I went to work creating stories designed to develop in him self-reliance, imagination, and a keen desire to hear and to be normal. There was one story in particular which I emphasized by giving it some new and dramatic coloring each time it was told. It was designed to plant in his mind the thought that his affliction was not a liability but an asset of great value. Despite the fact that all the philosophy I had examined clearly indicated that every adversity brings with it the seed of an equivalent advantage, I must confess that I had not the slightest idea how this affliction could ever become an asset. However, I continued my practice of wrapping that philosophy in bedtime stories, hoping the time would come when he would find some plan by which his handicap could be made to serve some useful purpose. Reason told me plainly that there was no adequate compensation for the lack of ears and natural hearing equipment. Desire, backed by faith, pushed reason aside and inspired me to carry on. As I analyze the experience in retrospect, I can see now that my son's faith in me had much to do with the astounding results. He did not question anything I told him. I sold him the idea that he had a distinct advantage over his older brother, and that this advantage would reflect itself in many ways. For example, the teachers in school would observe that he had no ears, and, because of this, they would show him special attention and treat him with extraordinary kindness. They always did. His mother saw to that by visiting the teachers and arranging with them to give the child the extra attention necessary. I sold him the idea, too, that when he became old enough to sell newspapers, his older brother had already become a newspaper merchant, he would have a big advantage over his brother for the reason that people would pay him extra money for his wares because they could see that he was a bright, industrious boy despite the fact that he had no ears. We could notice that gradually the child's hearing was improving. Moreover, he had not the slightest tendency to be self-conscious because of his affliction. When he was about 7, he showed the first evidence that our method of servicing his mind was bearing fruit. For several months, he begged for the privilege of selling newspapers, but his mother would not give her consent. She was afraid that his deafness made it unsafe for him to go on the street alone. Finally, he took matters in his own hands. One afternoon, when he was left at home with the servants, he climbed through the kitchen window, shinned to the ground, and set out on his own. He borrowed 6 cents in capital from the neighborhood shoemaker, invested it in papers, sold out, reinvested, and kept repeating until late in the evening. After balancing his accounts and paying back the 6 cents he had borrowed from his banker, he had a net profit of 42 cents. When we got home that night, we found him in bed asleep with the money tightly clenched in his hand. His mother opened his hand, removed the coins, and cried. Of all things, crying over her son's first victory seemed so inappropriate. My reaction was the reverse. I laughed heartily, for I knew that my endeavor to plant in the child's mind an attitude of faith in himself had been successful. His mother saw in his first business venture a little deaf boy who had gone out in the streets and risked his life to earn money. I saw a brave, ambitious, self-reliant little businessman whose stock in himself had been increased 100% because he had gone into business on his own initiative and had won. The transaction pleased me because I knew that he had given evidence of a trait of resourcefulness that would go through him all through life. Later events proved this to be true. When his older brother wanted something, he would lie down on the floor, kick his feet in the air, cry for it, and get it. When the little deaf boy wanted something, he would plan a way to earn the money, then buy it for himself. He still follows that plan. Truly, my own son has taught me that handicaps can be converted into stepping stones on which one may climb towards some worthy goal, unless they are accepted as obstacles and used as alibis. The little deaf boy went through the grades, high school and college, without being able to hear his teachers, excepting when they shouted loudly at close range. He did not go to a school for the deaf. We would not permit him to learn the sign language. We were determined that he should live a normal life and associate with normal children, and we stood by that decision, although it cost us many heated debates with school officials. While he was in high school, he tried an electrical hearing aid, but it was of no value to him, due, we believed, to a condition that was disclosed when the child was 6 by Dr. J. Gordon Wilson of Chicago, when he operated on one side of the boy's head and discovered that there was no sign of natural hearing equipment. During his last week in college, 18 years after the operation, something happened which marked the most important turning point of his life. Through what seemed to be mere chance, he came into possession of another electrical hearing device, which was sent to him on trial. He was slow about testing it due to his disappointment with a similar device. Finally, he picked up the instrument and more or less carelessly placed it on his head, hooked up the battery, and lo, as if by a stroke of magic, his lifelong desire for normal hearing became a reality. For the first time in his life, he heard practically as well as any person with normal hearing. God moves in mysterious ways his wonders to perform. Overjoyed because of the changed world which had been brought to him through his hearing device, he rushed to the telephone, called his mother, and heard her voice perfectly. The next day, he plainly heard the voices of his professors in class for the first time in his life. Previously, he could hear them only when they shouted at short range. He heard the radio. He heard the talking pictures. For the first time in his life, he could converse freely with other people without the necessity of their having to speak loudly. Truly, he had come into possession of a changed world. We had refused to accept nature's error, and by persistent desire, we had induced nature to correct that error through the only practical means available. Desire had commenced to pay dividends, but the victory was not yet complete. The boy still had to find a definite and practical way to convert his handicap into an equivalent asset. Hardly realizing the significance of what had already been accomplished, but intoxicated with the joy of his newly discovered world of sound, he wrote a letter to the manufacturer of the hearing aid, enthusiastically describing his experience. Something in his letter, something perhaps which was not written on the lines but back of them, caused the company to invite him to New York. When he arrived, he was escorted through the factory, and while talking with the chief engineer, telling him about his changed world, a hunch, an idea, or an inspiration, call it what you will, flashed into his mind. It was this impulse of thought which converted his affliction into an asset, destined to pay dividends in both money and happiness to thousands for all time to come. The sum and substance of that impulse of thought was this. It occurred to him that he might be of help to the millions of deafened people who go through life without the benefit of a hearing device, if he could find a way to tell them the story of his changed world. Then and there, he reached a decision to devote the remainder of his life to rendering useful service to the hard of hearing. For an entire month, he carried on an intensive research during which he analyzed the entire marketing system of the manufacturer of the hearing device and created ways and means of communicating with the hard of hearing all over the world for the purpose of sharing with them his newly discovered changed world. When this was done, he put in writing a 2-year plan based upon his findings. When he presented the plan to the company, he was instantly given a position for the purpose of carrying out his ambition. Little did he dream when he went to work that he was destined to bring hope and practical relief to thousands of deafened people who, without his help, would have been doomed forever to deaf mutism. Shortly after he became associated with the manufacturer of his hearing aid, he invited me to attend a class conducted by his company for the purpose of teaching deaf mutes to hear and to speak. I had never heard of such a form of education, therefore I visited the class, skeptical but hopeful that my time would not be entirely wasted. Here I saw a demonstration which gave me a greatly enlarged vision of what I had done to arouse and keep alive in my son's mind the desire for normal hearing. I saw deaf mutes actually being taught to hear and to speak through application of the self-same principle I had used more than 20 years previously in saving my son from deaf mutism. Thus, through some strange turn of the wheel of fate, my son Blair and I have been destined to aid in correcting deaf mutism for those as yet unborn, because we are the only living human beings, as far as I know, who have established definitely the fact that deaf mutism can be corrected to the extent of restoring to normal life those who suffer with this affliction. It has been done for one, it will be done for others. There is no doubt in my mind that Blair would have been a deaf mute all his life if his mother and I had not managed to shape his mind as we did. The doctor who attended at his birth told us confidentially the child might never hear or speak. A few weeks ago, Dr. Irving Voorhees, a noted specialist on such cases, examined Blair very thoroughly. He was astounded when he learned how well my son now hears and speaks, and said his examination indicated that theoretically the boy should not be able to hear at all. But the lad does hear, despite the fact that X-ray pictures show there is no opening in the skull whatsoever from where his ears should be to the brain. When I planted in his mind the desire to hear and talk and live as a normal person, there went with that impulse some strange influence which caused nature to become bridge builder and span the gulf of silence between his brain and the outer world by some means which the keenest medical specialists have not been able to interpret. It would be sacrilege for me to even conjecture as to how nature performed this miracle. It would be unforgivable if I neglected to tell the world as much as I know of the humble part I assumed in the strange experience. It is my duty and a privilege to say I believe, and not without reason, that nothing is impossible to the person who backs desire with enduring faith. Verily, a burning desire has devious ways of transmuting itself into its physical equivalent. Blair desired normal hearing. Now he has it. He was born with a handicap, which might easily have sent one with a less defined desire to the street with a bundle of pencils and a tin cup. That handicap now promises to serve as the medium by which he will render useful service to many millions of hard of hearing. Also to give him useful employment at adequate financial compensation the remainder of his life. The, quote, white lie, little white lies, close quote, I planted in his mind when he was a child by leading him to believe his affliction would become a great asset which he could capitalize, has justified itself. Verily, there is nothing right or wrong which belief plus burning desire cannot make real. These qualities are free to everyone. In all my experience in dealing with men and women who had personal problems, I never handled a single case which more definitely demonstrates the power of desire. Authors sometimes make the mistake of writing of subjects of which they have but superficial or very elementary knowledge. It has been my good fortune to have the privilege of testing the soundness of the power of desire through the affliction of my own son. Perhaps it was providential that the experience came as it did, for surely no one is better prepared than he to serve as an example of what happens when desire is put to the test. If Mother Nature bends to the will of desire, is it logical that mere men can defeat a burning desire? Strange and imponderable is the power of the human mind. We do not understand the method by which it uses every circumstance, every individual, every physical thing within its reach as a means of transmuting desire into its physical counterpart. Perhaps science will uncover this secret. I planted in my son's mind the desire to hear and to speak as any normal person hears and speaks. That desire has now become a reality. I planted in his mind the desire to convert his greatest handicap into his greatest asset. That desire has been realized. The modus operandi by which this astounding result was achieved is not hard to describe. It consisted of three very definite facts. First, I mixed faith with the desire for normal hearing, which I passed on to my son. Second, I communicated my desire to him in every conceivable way available through persistent, continuous effort over a period of years. Third, he believed me. As this chapter was being completed, news came of the death of Madame Schumann-Heink. One short paragraph in the news dispatch gives the clue to this unusual woman's stupendous success as a singer. I quote the paragraph because the clue it contains is none other than desire. Early in her career, Madame Schumann-Heink visited the director of the Vienna Court Opera to have him test her voice, but he did not test it. After taking one look at the awkward and poorly dressed girl, he exclaimed, none too gently, "With such a face, and with no personality at all, how can you ever expect to succeed in opera? My good child, give up the idea, buy a sewing machine, and go to work. You can never be a singer." Never is a long time. The director of the Vienna Court Opera knew much about the technique of singing. He knew little about the power of desire when it assumes the proportion of an obsession. If he had known more of that power, he would not have made the mistake of condemning genius without giving it an opportunity. Several years ago, one of my business associates became ill. He became worse as time went on and finally was taken to the hospital for an operation. Just before he was wheeled into the operating room, I took a look at him and wondered how anyone as thin and emaciated as he could possibly go through a major operation successfully. The doctor warned me that there was little, if any, chance of my ever seeing him alive again. But that was the doctor's opinion. It was not the opinion of the patient. Just before he was wheeled away, he whispered feebly, "Do not be disturbed, Chief. I will be out of here in a few days." The attending nurse looked at me with pity, but the patient did come through safely. After it was all over, his physician said, "Nothing but his own desire to live saved him. He never would have pulled through if he had not refused to accept the possibility of death." I believe in the power of desire backed by faith, because I have seen this power lift men from lowly beginnings to places of power and wealth. I have seen it rob the grave of its victims. I have seen it serve as the medium by which men staged a comeback after having been defeated in 100 different ways. I have seen it provide my own son with a normal, happy, successful life, despite nature's having sent him into the world without ears. How can one harness and use the power of desire? This has been answered through this and subsequent chapters of this book. This message is going out to the world at the end of the longest and perhaps the most devastating depression America has ever known. It is reasonable to presume that the message may come to the attention of many who have been wounded by the depression, those who have lost their fortunes, others who have lost their positions, and great numbers who must recognize their plans and stage a comeback. To all these, I wish to convey the thought that all achievement, no matter what may be its nature or its purpose, must begin with an intense, burning desire for something definite. Through some strange and powerful principle of mental chemistry, which she has never divulged, nature wraps up in the impulse of strong desire that something which recognizes no such word as impossible and accepts no such reality as failure. And I'm about to open up the lines for discussion, and I'm excited to hear what you have pulled out of this chapter, but I do want to make one comment before I open up the lines, and that is this. Do you think that it's a coincidence that Dr. Napoleon Hill, who was commissioned to spend 20 years of his life by Andrew Carnegie to study the most successful people who ever lived on the face of the earth, financially successful, and extract the principles and put them down in a form which all people could understand, and then deliver that message to the world? This was his mission, to find the principles, to find the laws, to put them down in a book and be the messenger to the world for this philosophy. This was his mission. Do you think it's a coincidence that his son was sent to him without ears? And do you think it's a coincidence that he went through this experience where he learned firsthand the power of these principles, and that he was able to gain a personal testimony of these principles and how they work? I'll leave you to come to the answer to that question, but I'll tell you, I know the answer. I know the answer that I've come to. Open up the line. *6 to unmute your line.
Good morning, Paul.
Hey, good morning, Melvin.
Yeah, I did get something from that chapter. One of the things that I've been hearing it for so many years, this thing about burning desire, and you also made you mentioned strong desire, and I was thinking prior to that, desire is everyone is doing what they desire right now. I mean, everyone's doing that. Desire determines the actions that we take, and all those desires that we have, you know, be they big or small, it's a desire that a person has. In fact, it's a desire to do nothing. You know, that person desires to not take any action or do anything. And so I was thinking about that desire, and since it relates to every single thing we do, then the major difference is when you have, what I heard you mention several times, a burning desire. When you have it and you feel it strong enough, And that's what's needed for anything of greatness, anything of real achievement, is not just to desire something that we're doing, because you can desire just to do nothing, but a burning desire, something you feel strong enough and passionate enough about it, because faith and desire go very much hand in hand, that you're willing to act upon that and make that thing become a reality. And the other thing you mentioned is the fact that it's free. It's free to everyone. So everyone has it. It's just up to each of us to turn that into a burning desire, that which we really wish to accomplish, and act upon it. Back to you, Paul.
Wow, excellent points, Melvin. Really appreciate that. Star 6, who's next? Yes, good morning. Who's that?
This is Neville.
Hey, good morning, Neville.
You know, you call for the burning desire, and I missed your first part of your monologue this morning because you were discussing a movie you had seen with your children. But over the weekend, I saw the movie again, Braveheart. And burning desire, the desire to be free, was what drove Wallace. I remember the fact that, you know, it didn't start out that way. You know, it started that way because, you know, people abused him and killed his wife. But as he moved forward to control his life, it is as if all the deceit and deception that took place and denied him, he had that burning desire. But the desire that he had what I would call honesty and integrity with how he dealt with everybody. He never deviated from that honesty, that direct approach, that telling people what's there and what to expect and how to do it. And when you have a burning desire to achieve for yourself and your family, then you can see what was in Dr. Hill's mind. Matter of fact, when he started, I don't think he was contemplating the fact he was on a course searching to find out what makes people tick. He just had that belief, that faith, that, yes, this is something which is possible. Even though I've never seen it, but I tell you, we walk by faith and not by sight. He walked by faith. He believed. And the awesome thing about it in believing, he created the same belief in his child. And once that trust was created in his child and he had a commitment to it, then nature, Mother Nature, bent to the will of the desire. It is awesome. It is awesome. It is awesome. Now, thank you, Paul. Back to you.
Wow, Neville, you made some great points there. You know, and I thought, as you were talking, I thought back to Melvin's comments, how he pointed out that there's a difference between desire and burning desire. And he pointed out that we all have desire. We all have desire. And that desire is working for us. The fact is, though, a lot of us have weak desires, and our desires are scattered in many different directions, and weak desires produce weak results. And Neville, as you talked there, I started to reflect on the truth that desire is something that can be cultivated. And that's an exciting thing, is to understand that we all have desire, but to understand that to have something truly significant happen as a result of that desire, it has to be nurtured, it has to be cultivated, it has to be taken from starting out maybe as a mere want to becoming that burning desire or that obsession. And I think about my journey in the home business industry. When I first learned about this concept that you could be financially free and that you could generate enough passive income to where you wouldn't have to have a job and your time could be freed up, it started out as a want. I saw that and I thought, wow, man, that would be nice. I'd like to have that. And I was working at my job full time, and as it started out as a want, I started to do a little bit of different things, you know, joined a network marketing company, made a few calls here and there. But as I continued to read books and as I continued to go down this journey, and then as I found the book Think and Grow Rich a couple of years ago, and I realized that you could really do some things to cultivate and turn this into a white hot burning desire, everything changed when I started to learn and apply that. So I just wanted to point that out, some things that I realized as both Melvin and Neville, you were talking. Star 6, who's next? Come on out.
Judy from Florida.
Judy, good morning.
Good morning. I hope you're doing well and fine. I love that movie, The Princess Bride. It is one of my favorites. One of the things that's coming to my mind as we read this chapter, and Napoleon Hill talks about he and his wife had induced nature to correct error through the only practical means available, and that is, you know, thought manifests itself into the physical. And what's in my mind right now is that Jesus was teaching us the same thing. How he taught us that we too can move mountains. And he was talking about burning desire and thought and how powerful it is and manifests itself into physical reality. You know, and through time, we've had different teachers telling us and giving us all this knowledge in a language that the masses can understand as evolution continues. You know, the language of the carpenter's day was different than the language of today. And nature has provided all these teachers to explain things to us in a language that we can understand and we can put into practice. And I just wanted to share that, how powerful that is for me and how wonderful this is. Everybody have an awesome day, whether you want to or not. I love you, and back to you, Paul.
Great thoughts, Judy. Glenn, thank you.
Is now muted.
Oh.
Hey, Paul, how are you doing?
Yeah, Star 6, who is that? I heard a male voice there. Star 6 to unmute
Glenn
your line again.
Is now unmuted.
Can you hear me now, Paul?
Yes, yes. There's a bit of an echo there. If you're done speaking, please press Star 6 to mute your line. Go ahead, sir.
All right, this is Super Duper Stan here in North Carolina. And I was just listening to what you were saying and looking back over your life and your entry into the network marketing industry, and myself as a farm boy who was born into poverty. Basically, we just had a lot of love in the family, but I knew myself that I wanted to be free. And of course, as I went down that road, just like you said about the reading the books and all that stuff, with the first network marketing venture that I involved myself in and I started reading, I wanted to mention too about that desire. Of course, I had that strong desire to be financially free, but as the previous caller mentioned, that there are different degrees of desire, that takes a decision to move to that next level, and that's where I found myself, you know, making that decision. And I'll never forget this particular, I was at a seminar one time where this man made a statement on stage, and he said, "You are where you are right now because you decided to be there." And at that time, broke as I could be, I almost hollered out in the crowd, "Heck no, I ain't either," because I was real broke. But I realized that decision, so many people, and I'm conscious now not to use average because of a call we had last week, I think it was, and I love that because God made all of us, and he gave us all of this equipment, so all of us, you know, none of us are average, but we choose to do things. And so that decision is so important to make that decision. Of course, that desire has to be there to begin with, and as you make those decisions and you move down the road, I feel that desire will increase, just like you said, and that's the thing, and never quitting, that's the thing that will cause you to move from point A to point B to point C, and next thing you know, you'll be all the way to reaching your destination and your goals. Just wanted to share that with you. Hope everyone have a super-duper day. Back to you, Paul.
Super-duper, Stan. You are super-duper. Thank you for those great thoughts and insight. Absolutely amazing. Really appreciate that. Star 6, who's next?
Hey, good morning, guys. It's Doc Fran.
Good morning, Doc.
And, you know, this is one of the most amazing chapters in this book. And first time I read it, I went, you know, can this really be real? And you know, it is real. I've researched it. It really struck me this morning, the way that you've framed the discussion, that there's a huge difference between a wish and a burning desire. And a lot of people wish they had more money, or they wish they had $1 million, or they wish they were 7 feet tall or 6'4" or whatever, or they wish this and wish that. And we all know the expression that if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. So the burning desire versus a wish is inherent in that, not only the need for and the desire for, but the intensity and the willingness to accomplish it. Failure is not an option. So then when I look at this chapter, and we've talked at many different times about how we co-create every event in our life to fulfill our needs and our purposes in life. And just the same as Napoleon Hill was absolutely genius enough to conceive and follow through on this extraordinary life's work of proving that thoughts become things, isn't it amazing that in order to actually prove the validity to himself of his own theory, he created the most amazing, impossible, incontrovertible proof that his philosophy was real? He actually co-created a son that was born without any discernible hearing apparatus and went to work to apply his beliefs to that reality to prove to himself, to his son, and to the world that this works. Back to you, Paul.
That is amazing. That is fascinating, Doc. As you're talking, my mind is just soaring, thinking about just how amazing that is. I mean, it is amazing. Star 6, who's next?
Come on out.
Okay, I'll throw something out there real quick here. You know, we think about a seed that grows into a flower, or a seed that grows into an oak tree, and we know that in that seed, there's some sort of power there that scientists can't describe, and that really no one has been able to describe, other than, you know, there's a life force, there's some kind of code in there, some kind of force that causes that seed to grow into what it's supposed to become. Is it possible that desire is somewhat related to that power that exists in nature, in all living things, from the smallest seed to other things that exist? Just a thought I want to throw out there. Star 6, who's next?
And actually, let me try and get rid of that.
Okay, Star 6, who's next?
Hey, Paul.
I think the echo's gone. Yeah. Hey, Todd, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, my friend. You know, I love this chapter. It's dear to me because my great-grandparents were deaf-mutes, and my father was born and raised by his grandparents, of course, who were deaf-mutes. You know, as many times as I've read this book, you know, over and over and over, you know, it was amazing how you know, throughout my life, I've noticed that, and Doc Fran just really touched on it, which was just right on target, and that is that most people have, you know, desire to most people are wishes, and wishes are not desire. They just aren't. People don't know the how part when it comes to burning desire, and, you know, people just don't know, or they can't touch what is burning desire. A lot of people want to know, you know, how does this work? But burning desire is created when it's backed by faith, and faith is belief. So desire backed by faith is a mysterious force. Dr. Hill did not know how it worked, not in the early days. I know he did later on, wound up, you know, having his own conclusion because there is a formula here. But most people want to know how things work, and it's just like our industry. I really relate this chapter to our industry. And that is a lot of people want to know how things work. You know, you give somebody an assignment or a homework assignment, or we go and do a coaching call, or we do a coaching call, and then people think in their brain, you know, their brain processes automatically goes to, well, gosh, how does this work? When your brain starts to do that, you impede that burning desire because you don't need to know how burning desire works. It's created when it's backed by faith. So that's the faith part. The faith is your belief. You just have to believe whatever it is that you are doing or whatever it is that you are thinking with strong emotion that this is true. Burning desire, it's not just desire, it's that burning, that word burning, white hot burning desire for whatever it is that you want. That burning desire is part of that emotion that Dr. Napoleon Hill talks about. That burning desire is that faith. Burning desire is that belief. So you just can't have wishes. You just can't have desire. It must be back with faith and emotion and belief, just like Dr. Napoleon Hill knew that his son was going to speak one day. And through the formless substance and the ether of the universe, when you have a burning desire, that formless substance and that ether, and of course you must have extreme gratitude, that formless substance will be attracted to you like a magnet. Paul, back to you.
Great thoughts and wisdom as always, Todd Nuclear Young. Really appreciate that. I love, you know, as I was listening to you, I just reminded myself of how awesome it is to be on this call and hearing everyone's experience and wisdom. It just embeds this stuff deeper and deeper and deeper into my mind, into my subconscious mind, into my soul, so that I understand it just a little bit better, so that I can move forward with all of this stuff being a little bit more automatic for me. So, Todd, thank you for that. Star 6, who's next?
Good morning, Paul.
Paul, it's Sandy.
Let's see, gentleman's voice and then Sandy.
Yeah, this is Mark from Maine.
Hey, Mark, go ahead, sir.
Okay, sorry to butt in front of you there, Sandy, but yeah, to answer your questions that you asked earlier, the answer is no, it wasn't just coincidence. He was being prepared for this by doing the job for Mr. Carnegie, and now he was putting into practice what he needed to write about by helping his son, who was would be deaf and mute because of his birth defect. But it happened for a reason. Our lives aren't full of coincidences. They're full of actions that are meant for a reason. There's a purpose in everything that is brought to us. It's what we do with it is what counts. If we take a birth defect like the Napoleon Hill's son with no ears, and we throw our hands in the air and say, well, that's it. You know, there's nothing we can do. The doctor said that he can't hear. Too bad. You know, what are we supposed to do? We don't have the education. But I appreciated so much what Todd just said and the others, Doc Fran, and about this burning desire. Yeah, we can have wishes, but when we have the faith, the grain of mustard seed, we can say unto this mountain, be thou removed, and it shall be. We can speak that into existence. But we first have to have the faith and realization that everything happens for a purpose. There's everything has its purpose, a time and a reason for the season. So it's just, it just gives me, with that faith and belief, those two is what will fuel our white-hot burning desire. So first of all, we have to have faith. Then we need to take that faith another step into belief. Then we have to take those two and feed the fire of desire so that it becomes not only just a plain desire or want or wish, but it becomes a white, hot, burning desire. Back to you.
Great thoughts, Mark. Really appreciate that. Sandy, go ahead.
Yes, Paul. Wow, it's like everybody has gotten the key words here in burning desire. I want to share a little story, and it's something I shared on my call that I do last night that I ended the call with, and it kind of goes along with, a little bit with what we're talking about. And it was a gorgeous day here yesterday. It was 80 degrees. The sky was just as blue as it could be. And I was outside playing with Noah and my two grandchildren, Jackson and Maya. And Maya is 2 years old. She just turned two. She talks very, very clearly. And she looks up at the sky and she says, "Look, Mimi, it's a bald eagle." And I said, "It's a what?" "It's a bald eagle." And I'm looking, I can't see anything. I'm looking, looking, and I said, "Where?" And she keeps pointing. And as we looked off way in the distance, there's three birds circling. Well, yeah, they sort of fly like a bald eagle. Of course they weren't. But in her eyes, they were a bald eagle. And I thought for a moment about where she had gotten that from, and I remembered little Einstein. You know, if anybody's ever seen those, they're just great for kids, classical music, and they teach kids a lot of things. And in her mind, at that moment, they were bald. There was a bald eagle up there. Did I have the heart to tell this two-year-old who was so excited over showing me the bald eagle that it was not? I did not. I did not tell her it wasn't a bald eagle. Why? Because in a two-year-old's mind, she's so excited. Her belief level is so strong that she believes that is a bald eagle. And so my first thought was, wow, you know, wow. Because through the mind of a child and through the eyes of a child, there is truly magic. And to me, at that moment, I saw the magic in her eyes of what she believed was a bald eagle. Will she find out later that they weren't bald eagles? She won't remember that I didn't tell her those weren't bald eagles, but at 2 years old, it was truly magical to see her excitement over telling me that they were a bald eagle. And then you were telling the story this morning about Napoleon Hill's son. It made me realize the burning desire that he had, that he gave his son, because his son is a child. And as a child, their belief level is so huge that when you instill that belief level in them, they will believe what you teach them. And so they believe. And because he had this burning desire for his son to hear, his son believed it from the time he was an infant. And that's what I believe he instilled in him that made him believe he could do it. So I just wanted to share that. It's a small thing, what Maya did, but in the long run, the belief level of a child is so strong that it's truly magical at what they see. And because Napoleon Hill instilled that in his child, his belief level was always there. And so, with that, back to you, Paul.
Sandy, thank you for sharing that. It's so applicable because as we're learning how to develop faith in our goal and our major definite purpose and, you know, whatever our vision of where we're heading, we need to learn to kind of go back and be like a child. One of the reasons I think children have such an ability to believe is they haven't been bogged down with all of the garbage that we as adults have gone through. You can't do this. You can't do that. You know, Napoleon Hill teaches us in this book, we need to get a dictionary and cut out the word impossible. And he teaches us through this story that really, are there really things that are, you know, impossible? Maybe some, but, you know, a lot of things that we say are impossible really are only impossible because our self-limiting beliefs, our self-limiting ideas of what's possible and what's not possible. So great example. Let's be more like children. Let us have that childlike faith, that belief in that major definite purpose. Even though we don't understand it, like Todd pointed out, we might not understand how it works, but when we start to cultivate this belief, this faith, along with this burning desire, magical stuff happens. Star 6, who's next?
Hello, Paul?
Yes.
This is Peter. I also want to point out the other side of that coin. Children have an amazing belief, so if we instill in them the belief that they can't, they shouldn't, they mustn't, we are doing the same amount of negative influence that we are talking about now, how we need to change so that we can insert the positive influence. And that vision of the bald eagle, I just remember my daughter walking over the canal one day and saying, "Hey, look, Daddy, the sun's going for a swim." For her, the sun was going for a swim because she saw the reflection and she didn't see the sun. So, over to you, Paul.
That's awesome, Peter. Thank you, thank you, thank you for that. Really appreciate that. Star 6, who's next?
Hi, Paul. It's Lindy.
Hey, Lindy. Good morning.
Good morning. I had the most amazing experience over the weekend that just falls right in line with what we're talking about this morning. And it really wasn't my experience. I was actually the observer. But there was a festival at a town about 15 miles south of us. So we went there. It was a gorgeous day at 80 degrees, just beautiful, the coolest day we've had around here for months. And there was probably maybe 5,000 people at this event. And we walked around, played games, you know, had a lot of fun. We decided to sit under a tree for a little while and just enjoy watching people. And we happened to sit next to a mom and a dad and their four kids. And we struck up a conversation, and my granddaughter was there. She's 16. And the dad pulls out this really fancy camera. I mean, it was unbelievable. And he started shooting pictures, and we started talking about photography, and he starts showing us all his pictures, and it turns out he's a professional photographer. And my granddaughter really sparked up, and he started showing her all his photos he had on his camera, and then he got another camera out, this big fancy camera, and started letting her use it and take pictures. And I saw my granddaughter blossom. I'm getting goosebumps right now just talking about this, like I've never ever seen in my life. And when you're talking about burning desire, it's really, really easy to cultivate that when you put that on top of a passion. And I saw a passion come out in her I've never seen before. And before the day was over, we found out they only live 5 miles from us. He's going to mentor her in photography, and it is just, I've never seen anything like this. And do I think that was an accident? Absolutely not. We have to be open to the opportunities that God lays before us. We have to be open to grab hold of them and run with them and just do what we can with them, and knowing that every step of the way we're going to get better and better and better. Nobody's perfect at first. Nobody's perfect ever, but the more you practice, the better you get. So I just wanted to share that because it was just unbelievable to see this, you know, right in front of me, open up. So back to you, Paul.
Lindy, wow, so powerful. Thank you very much for sharing that experience. And folks, thanks to everyone who shared today. You know, as we've gone through the discussion, and I think about the message, we realize this story is meant to illustrate, obviously, desire, and not just desire, but burning desire. So what I want to do right now is ask everyone to ponder today, what is your major definite purpose? And rate your level of desire. Is it low? Is it average? Is it, you know, a 25 on a scale of 1 to 10? Is it burning? Is it white hot? Where is it? Where's your level of desire? We all need improvement in this area, and guess what? Tomorrow, Dr. Napoleon Hill is going to teach us how to take that desire level, wherever it's at on the scale, and up it and up it and up it and nourish it and stoke that fire, throw wood and gasoline and all this kind of, you know, high flammable stuff on that fire to turn it into that white hot burning desire that we're going to need to get to where we need to go. So that's tomorrow, folks. Thanks for being here. Love you. Appreciate you. Get out there and make it a great day. Take action. We'll see you back here tomorrow morning on the Think and Grow Rich Call. Take care, everyone.